Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 61, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
What's this in my hand?
Oh my God.
Now, I must apologise if I do get a little bit distracted during this week's show. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
You want me to do it, don't you?
Go on, go on. Satisfying sound.
I've got my hands on the Nintendo Switch.
Oh, nice.
And well, I got it on launch day.
Well, I've just bought a Wii U, so I'm a bit behind.
Now, obviously, we're a retro gaming podcast. There is some good kind of stuff on the Switch that does appeal to retro gamers, I think. So,
okay, so we'll cover it a bit in the news. And
yeah. I'll tell you why I got it and what I think of it so far. And also, you've not got your hands on one yet, have you?
No, I've not even touched one yet, Dan, so...
I might not let you touch it, actually. This side of the desk. But yeah, we'll talk more about the Switch. Obviously, Nintendo, what a legendary company. Whenever a new console comes out, it's worth talking about, I think, from someone as
legendary.
Yeah, it's
pretty much everywhere at the moment,
exactly.
So we've got to cover it.
Exactly. So that is coming up in just a bit. I'll give you my initial thoughts on the Nintendo Switch. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it worth buying yet?
What's it taste like?
Yeah, we need to talk about that as well. People are like, what? And also, on the Retro Hour every week, now, we work very hard to try and bring you veterans of the video game industry. And this week, it's kind of a little bit different to... you know, what we've kind of covered in the past. I mean, we're kind of moving into like the late 90s with this week's guest. And obviously, you know, we've covered FPSs in the past, like we had John Romero on, we covered Doom. This is kind of the next generation of FPSs after that. Counter-Strike.
Yeah, and, you know, we've got Min Lay, Gooseman Min Lay, who is basically the creator of Counter-Strike. Now, this was a mod that became a full game, which, you know, is unprecedented. And it's absolutely fantastically popular worldwide, Counter-Strike. It's still, you know, Counter-Strike Source is one of the number one FPSs.
And Min's got an interesting story. I mean, you know, like many of these, he started on like the Commodore 64 and the Amiga. And really, it was kind of when, you know, he went to university in the mid-90s and it was Quake that really captured his attention, wasn't it?
Yeah, that kind of early multiplayer online communities. But they were still doing it on like 56K modems. I don't know how they could have kept up or done headshots and stuff on that.
Well, we'll find out in a bit. Yeah. So Min Lay, the guy behind the legendary Counter-Strike, is going to be our very special guest on this week's Retro Hour. If you're a fan of FPSs and those kind of early days of it, make sure you hang around for this really interesting interview this week. And of course, the Retro Hour podcast would not be possible without the people who go out of their way every week to head to our website, theretrohour.com, click on that little PayPal link and find it in their hearts to donate a couple of quid into the cause.
Yeah, and that enters them automatically to the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
What an accolade.
Totally.
So making the Retro Hour Hall of Fame this week, we want to say a massive thank you from the bottom of our hearts to D. Lawless,
Scott McDonald,
Catherine Palacios,
Peter Bovin,
and Emma Ray, who all made very generous donations at theretrohour.com this week, which is a website you need to go to. If you ever want to put a couple of quid in the tip jar, everything you give us goes towards the running of the show, and we appreciate every penny that we get. Thank you so much for that, guys. Now, of course, with this show, we like to give back as well.
Yeah, and we have got a fabulous giveaway. This is our first hardware giveaway.
We're giving away a computer.
Totally, yeah.
Now, in the week, this is really cool because this guy... he lives in Nottingham, where we do.
Yeah, Spencer.
And, yeah, a guy called Spencer. He dropped us a tweet a couple of weeks ago and said, look, guys, you know, I've got something for you. Do you want to come and meet us? And we were like, oh, okay. We'll come meet up with him. And he turned up. We actually met him in a cinema in the afternoon the other week. He turned up with a little kind of inconspicuous-looking little brown box.
And he started pulling out all these little modules and he had a little easel with a screen on it and kind of started plugging it all in. And it was this tiny little breadboard kind of... Z80 machine, you know, a little build-it-your-own kit.
I did see that the room start to evacuate when he started getting wires and stuff out.
Yeah, people are like, what are these guys doing in the middle of the cafe?
But now, we were like blown away when we saw this. He's actually made, and he sells these kits, and actually it's his full-time job now, isn't it, doing this?
Yeah, yeah, and it's modular kits. Yeah. So it's kind of like the Z80 has been built in, the only way I can say it is like a toaster tray.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got your boards and you insert your different ones like bits of toast and you can kind of have different add-ons on it. So he's making an SD card adapter for it. And, you know, this is just for the Z80 processor. So he can display ASCII out of it at the moment and any kind of text numeral stuff. But you can also be compatible with other Z80 machines. So, you know, eventually you could get compatibility with the Game Boy or the Jupiter Ace, or, you know, the Spectrum, like anyone that was in the Z80 family.
Yeah, I mean, he said, you know, it's essentially, it's not really a clone of anything specific. It is a modern Z80-based modular computer. And it runs Microsoft BASIC, you know, as soon as you boot it up, it's got that in there at the moment. But it's kind of, you know, inherited the spirit of stuff like the ZX81, the Superboard 2, the S100, the Apple 1 as well. Yeah.
It's called the RC2014.
Yeah, it was actually a competition he entered in at first, wasn't he? But then people started contacting him like, you know, can we buy one of these kits? And the thing about it is, I mean, it kind of harks back to the earliest days of home computers. It is a build-it-yourself kit. And, you know, we're going to give one away this week on the show.
Yep.
So you need some, you know, minimal soldering skills.
But I think, you know, this would be perfect for somebody with their kids.
Yeah.
Who is like, right, Z80, this is what we used to have. But instead of explaining it, you sit there and build it and learn how it's working.
Yeah, that'd be, I mean, I remember building stuff like, you know, radios and Morse code stuff and, you know, in like technology class at school. But yeah, sitting down with your dad and actually building a computer together, like you said, for a father and son project or father and daughter project, that'd be amazing, wouldn't
it? But I would say soldering skills are essential for this one because me and Dan probably couldn't construct it ourselves. Yeah. So, you know, you have to be a bit of a... of an advanced electronics guy. Not massively, but, you know.
Yeah, you need to be able to know...
a competent level.
Which way around to hold a soldering iron.
Yeah.
So, if you'd like to win one of these, and I mean, you know, everything is included in this kit. So, if you'd like to win an RC2014 Build-It-Yourself Computer Kit, that is our competition on this week's show. Now, all you have to do to be in with a chance of winning is head to our website, theretrohour.com. We'll also pop this link on our Facebook and Twitter as well. And we've got a little question there that you need to answer. Now, obviously, the Z80 is a processor. So we want to know, what does the Z in Z80 stand for?
A, Zelda. B, Zipper. C, Zilog.
So only one of those is correct.
Yep.
Which one do you think, A, B, or C? All you got to do is head to our website, theretrohour.com. Leave us your details and your answer on there. We're going to give you 2 weeks to enter this competition. So it's open now, and it'll close on Friday, the 24th of March at 23:59. Very precise.
Yeah.
All the terms and conditions and everything can be found on there as well. And what we'll do when the competition closes, we'll go through all the correct entries, pick one out at random. If it's you, you'll win one of these build-it-yourself RC2014 Z80 kits.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah, it looks awesome. It looks
seriously cool. I'm thinking about getting one myself.
Yeah, well, he did say, didn't he? I mean, we might have to get one made of him.
Yeah, we might have to get it pre-assembled. You know.
Now, there is some other very exciting news out this week. Now, friend of the show, David Pleasance.
Oh, yes, the former managing director of Commodore UK.
Yeah, I mean, David's a guy who spent 12 years at Commodore. One of our early guests as well on the show. Probably about a year ago we had him on.
Yeah, and he was there from kind of, you know, the very start to the very end.
Yeah, well, the computer division, he was at the PET he started selling, didn't he? The computer, the Commodore PET. And then, yeah, you know, he was a guy that tried to buy out the Amiga after Commodore went bankrupt. So you think he's very uniquely placed to give, like, kind of the definitive history on what happened at Commodore during their heyday, which is quite fortunate because he's decided to write a book.
Oh, this is going to be good. All the stuff's going to come out in this. It's like we've heard stories from David that we can't mention on the air and stuff. And we're sure a lot of them are going to be in the book. But there's some insane stuff, guys. Seriously, you would not believe how bad Commodore were.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you know, I've got to do a little disclaimer here. We are actually helping David with some aspects of the book. You know, we're going to be releasing like a Blu-ray interview that, you know, we're going to be doing with David.
Yeah, we're helping set up the Kickstarter as well.
So, you know, we do have a, you know, not really a personal interest financially at all in this, you know. We just want to see this book come out.
Yeah, and we want to see all these stories come out. So you guys are like, oh, wow, that's actually what happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's all these rumours and all of this stuff will be totally cleared up in this book.
Well, the thing is, I mean, there has been quite a few documentaries and, you know, other books about Commodore, you know, The Company on the Edge, Brian Bagnell book, which is a really good read. But this is really, it's the first one that's been written by someone who is at the epicentre of the whole thing.
Totally. And it's not just David is going to be doing it. You know, there's going to be Dave Haney as well, who was basically the engineer for Commodore. And at the end, he had all the plans for the future Amiga machines, and they'd implemented a lot of them. So, you know, he's going to tell us what could have happened and what could have been.
And, you know, there are lots of people are going to be getting involved as well. Gail Wellington, I don't know if she's a name that you're familiar with. She was the head of CATS, Commodore Amiga Technical Support.
Excellent.
Very hands-on with the CDTV project that obviously cost Commodore a lot of money. And yep. She's going to be making, you know, a contribution to the book as well. So it's not just going to be, you know, one-sided. It's going to be really, you know, like I said earlier, the definitive history of Commodore from the inside.
Oh, I can't wait.
And the Kickstarter has just launched today.
Excellent.
So I'm going to pop this in our show notes, so theretrohour.com. We'll also share this in all of our social network links as well. If you want to find out what really happened with Commodore and why the company went under, the stuff that really happened behind the scenes, and, you know, I think this is a story. I mean, we always get the inside stories of Apple, Microsoft. This is a story that needs to be told.
What do they always say? The winners tell the story and yeah. The losers don't, and we're flipping it around.
But it's true. I mean, you know, Commodore, they're a company that kind of the mainstream kind of computer magazines and that, a lot of just kind of forget them.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's just been erased from history. So hopefully Dave can, you know, totally establish it and get all the facts out there.
Well, you know, we've interviewed David and we've known him for like years now. And he's like, you know, I think, yeah, like you said, the amount of stories I wish we could tell on this show that is yeah. like...
What did they say when they interviewed, when we did the interview with... Bedrooms to Billions, yep. because of Amiga years, they said David Pleasance was the most open person that they had and mm-hmm. was one of the best interviewees. So, yeah.
You know. Well, he's even, you know, when I was chatting to him and we were filming the little trailer for his Kickstarter, he was saying to me, you know, there are going to be lots of people very red-faced after I do this, but he said the whole thing's the truth, so, you know, he doesn't care as long as it's real.
Yeah, yeah, so excellent.
But there's a great bit in this video where I actually brought in a lot of my old Commodore machines.
Yeah.
And he got his hands on, like, you know, a Commodore 64 and an A1200 and stuff, you know, for the first time in years. And there's a bit in the trailer. I mean,
that's amazing, actually. You know, the guy who helped launch some of these products and actually seeing them again. And yeah. You can bring that to him. It's great.
There was one Amiga he didn't want to put his hands on, though. So you'll find that out if you watch your Kickstarter.
Definitely.
So absolutely back this, guys. You know, it should be out at the time of recording this. You know, we'll keep you up to date on that. You know, hopefully it's going to launch today. We'll stick that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we did mention that I've got my hands on this rather flashy bit of hardware this week.
Yeah, nice little device there.
The Nintendo Switch. Now, you remember we've been talking about it since it was the NX project last year?
Yeah, and the reason we've been talking about this is because we have seen so many companies go down the pan, like Commodore we just talked about, who had lots of money yeah. and were still doing well, like pretty much in the position Nintendo are at the moment. And we think this is make or break for them.
Well, I mean, you know, I think if it doesn't work out for them, they'll probably be on the way of Sega. You know,
yeah,
as in
software
just making
only.
Yeah, which, you know, might be where they head to. I did want to get one of these, maybe not quite so soon. I went out and bought this. Here you go. Get your hands on it, Ravi.
Oh, this looks nice.
Have a feel.
Oh, it's very solid.
It is. Well, it's a bit weightier than I expected, actually.
It doesn't feel cheap, and the analog sticks are really nice. Like the kind of, you know, you can just feel the micro switches.
Yeah, that's always nice and clicky. See, I went into my, it was the Sainsbury's I went into on Friday night, went in to get a loaf of bread, ended up coming out with a Nintendo Switch, forgot the bread, actually, which I was in the bad books with the missus for. But what may be slightly concerning is the fact that I went into Sainsbury's at 10 o'clock on Friday night and still had some in. They had like 10 in stock still.
Well, because Nintendo usually do that thing of holding back stock and stuff, so... Do you think they just went all out for this one?
Well, I did see them make a promise that there won't be the stock shortages that the Mini NES had.
I think I've just turned it on. Sorry.
It's going to boot up now, is it?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, the UI in it is so simple. I mean, there's even, you know, there's no web browser on it yet. There's no YouTube apps, nothing like that. It's literally just games, which is probably a good angle to launch a system with, you know, just focus on one thing and do
and
it
I
well.
I guess they can do firmware updates and stuff from far
yeah.
away.
And it's like, you know, I've got a couple of games on here. The one I didn't actually get Zelda because bizarrely, the Switch is quite easy to find. Zelda's not. It's like, I don't know what's going on there. But I've been playing Super Bomberman R. I mean, I love Bomberman. I like the Super Nintendo and that anyway,
yeah,
back in the day. Very faithful to it, actually. And there's also a game called Fast Remix. It's kind of like a Wipeout clone.
You know what? It reminds me of the Dreamcast. And I'm saying that in a sense of the innovation behind it. Because when the Dreamcast came out, they had, you know, that little unit you could pull out and take off.
The VMUs, Yeah.
They had all of these kind of little devices that were really... nice and innovative, but it didn't last that long.
Yeah.
And the Switch, it seems really nice and innovative. I just hope it stays for a long period of time, you know?
I mean, it would be nice to get that, you know, the new Mario Odyssey game, which is kind of like the, you know, the successor to Mario 64, really, a new version of that. But it's not going to be out till Christmas, unfortunately, which really, I think they should have had that out for launch, really.
You know? You need a Mario title, don't you? It's like it's like launching a Sega one without Sonic.
So, I mean, overall impression so far, pretty good, but I mean, it's only been out like, you know, the time recording this, like 3 days, and there is only about like 6-7 games that are available for it at the moment.
I must say,
one of which is Othello.
I must say, Dan, I've gone up to a few of my techie friends and I've said, oh, have you played with the Switch yet? And they go, what's the Switch?
Oh, no. It's not a good sign, is it?
Not a good sign.
No. Yeah, so, I mean, some people have asked me. I did, like, an unboxing video on Friday night when I got home, which I'll pop in our show notes as well if you want to watch it. A lot of the comments have been like, so do you think it's going to save Nintendo then? Is it going to work? You know, it's too early to tell, I think.
I think it probably won't be that successful, but then the second version or the third version will be really nice and have a mass uptake.
Well, I mean, time will tell.
But yeah, I could listen to this in a year and then be just like, oh my God.
Well, really,
what
I got
was it. I talking about?
I got it because I'm going on holiday in a couple of months and I thought, you know, I want to play Mario Kart 8 on the plane.
Nice.
And on the balcony because Samantha takes like an hour and a half to get ready. So I thought, you know, I can sit, have a drink and it's like, you know, play Mario Kart.
Well, I was saying to my girlfriend, you know, with the screens and Nintendo's being around with kids, I reckon the Switch screen repair industry is going to be massive.
Yeah, but it does feel like it could break. Apparently, there are some stories of people, you know, the dock you get with it.
Yeah.
Apparently, it's scratching the screen when you put it in.
Okay.
So you've got to be quite careful. But do you want to hear it one more time?
Yeah.
Go on then. Oh, I love that. I can just do all that.
We're just going to get removed off YouTube for having that sample now.
Yeah, Nintendo, copyright strike, that's our clip. So, you know, I'll keep you up to date with any interesting new titles, but initial thoughts on the Switch, promising, but, you know, time will tell. Mm. So if you've got one, you know, do let us know. What are you thinking of it? Drop us a tweet at Retro Hour UK. Now, we are going to have to get suited and booted in a couple of weeks' time.
Oh, God, not again. What's this for?
I know, like twice in a year. This is because the British Podcast Awards are coming up.
Oh, yes, and we have actually entered.
We have.
So it's going to be a very exciting one. This is a brand new Podcast Awards.
And this is, you know, we've been in for awards and stuff in the past, but this, I think, is the kind of saying this is the first kind of official podcast awards. You know, The Guardian are kind of behind this. They're one of the sponsors of it, and it's happening, you know. Swanky Awards do at the Platform Theatre in King's Cross in London. It's proper get suited up affair, and there's going to be, you know, some people that are kind of big in the media and radio industry are actually behind this.
Oh, so nice.
You know, we have gone in for the best new podcast.
Oh, fingers crossed.
So wish us luck. It's on at the end of next month, so we'll keep you posted. And either way, it'll be, you know, good excuse for a good night out.
Oh, yeah, good booze up in London.
Yeah, we're bringing Paul Kitchen and Joe. Joe's coming as well, so.
Oh, nice, and we can get on some hooch, old school style.
Yeah. WKD. We're not going to win, are we, for drinking that? Who are those guys? Get them out.
Yeah.
A little disclaimer, we don't drink hooch.
No. Anyway,
actually, I did have some hooch about a month ago.
Oh, God.
I was out in Newcastle.
Alco-pops.
With my brother, we're out, and we went to this, God, awful. We went to this, like, 90s bar. My brother's walking past, and they're playing, do you remember Sash, Mysterious Times?
Oh, we've
got to go in there.
I would have been in there.
And he's like, let's pretend like we're teenagers again. And it was the vilest thing I've ever had in my life. And like two sips, I was like, yeah, no, let's go somewhere and get a pint, shall we? So yeah, I won't be having hooch. Now, before we get into this week's interview, Prince of Persia, that was a classic.
Oh, it was a great game. I actually had some students that I work with, they'd come over from Italy.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were just talking about computers and stuff, and they were like, oh, Prince of Persia. So I gave them an Amiga 600 to have at their house, and they played Prince of Persia on that.
No, no way. Very generous.
Yeah, well, they lent it them for a year.
And did you ever have it back?
I think they really got far, but because it was really slow and laggy on that version, they were kind of like stuck. You know, you have to play it all the way through, don't you? In one sitting, Prince of Persia.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was like on the Amiga. Some of the later ones had like passwords stuff and that, I think. But I remember seeing it. I was probably only about, when did that game come out? Like, it was 1990, I think, wasn't it, the original? Mm. I remember going to stay with my cousin when I was young, and like my mum and her went out, and I stayed in with like a husband, and he was downstairs watching TV. And, you know, loving computers, I went upstairs and had like an old PC. I think it was like an Amstrad or something, and it had a black and white screen.
Yeah.
And I remember saying that to Roman, who was a husband. I said, like, you know, have you got any games on this? And he goes, oh, there's a couple, you know, to see what's in the box. And, you know, I had to kind of remember how MS-DOS works. I had an Amiga at the time. I was like, you know, load, what happens here? Eventually got Prince of Persia booted up in it, and that was the first time I played it.
Wow.
And it was like a pirated, like, you know, a proper 5.25-inch floppy disk he got off somewhere. Handwritten label, but even on like a monochrome, it's probably like CGA or something, or EGA, but it was like, I remember that was the first time I'd seen proper animated fluid movement in a video game.
Well, it was rotoscope, wasn't it? So it was, they kind of drew over the actions of a person running.
Yeah, it was a real life actor they drew over, yeah, traced. So, I mean, you know, and also very atmospheric game as well. You got kind of that, you know, that Arabia kind of nights kind of feel to it as well. Yeah. So, the reason we're mentioning this is obviously it's a classic game, but now there is actually a thing called SDL Pop, which is an open source port of Prince of Persia that runs on our Windows and Linux, which is basically a disassembly of the DOS version and uses SDL.
Nice. So I guess that might be compatible for other SDL systems as well.
It's cool that they've kind of, you know, disassembled this and actually released it for free. And also there's quite a big like modding community around it as well. Mm. So, you know, people are doing like custom levels and there's level editors and all that kind of thing involved with it as well. And it's a free download if you want to play
it. Is this a full trilogy then as well?
Yeah, well, I think that, I'm not sure if they've done all of them yet. I know they've done, this one only got released about, well, 5th of February. So it was only like, well, yesterday at the time of recording this.
So maybe they're going through.
Well, the website just says the Prince of Persia original trilogy, modding community it's on. So, you know, it's awesome. Just get the game for free, mess around with it. You know, they've even got the source code available on GitHub.
Yeah, you could add a Mario sprite in there and just go mad.
I'm sure there'll be all sorts of mad stuff gets done to it. So,
yeah, totally.
If you want to give that a download, I'll shove that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Right, thank you for checking out episode number 61 of the Retro Hour podcast. Don't forget, if you want to win that little computer kit, the RC2014 Z80, build it yourself computer kit, you've got 2 weeks to do it. Head to our website and answer this question. What does the Z in Z80 stand for?
A, Zelda. B, Zipper. C, Zilog.
Now, you've got 2 weeks to enter. Head to theretrohour.com. We'll pick a winner in a fortnight. Good luck. Right then, time to talk Counter-Strike.
Oh, God, yes. Knife kills, 56K modems.
Oh, you're getting
Steam.
Excited already.
Oh, I love it, yeah.
Here is this week's special guest, the amazing Min Lay, and we'll catch you next week.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is our pleasure to welcome this week's very special guest, the man behind the legendary Counter-Strike. Welcome to the show, Min Lay. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Now, let's get all the way back to the beginning. I'm quite interested to find out a bit about your history. I mean, what's your kind of earliest memory of computers or gaming then? Where did it all start for you?
I guess the first time I was exposed to computers was, I think, when I was around 7 or 8. My father bought a Commodore 64, and so that was my first exposure to computer games. And ever since then, I've been getting the latest hardware. Like from then, I got an Atari, and then I got an Amiga, and eventually I worked my way up to the PC with the first 8086. So I pretty much went through all of the iterations of like PCs, and throughout all of that, I really was exposed to pretty much every game that was ever released back then. And back then there weren't that many games, so I was able to like really play all of them. But as you know, these days, I mean, it's impossible to play all the games. But
do you have any favorite games from the Commodore 64 or the Amiga that kind of stick in your mind then?
I remember playing this one game. It was like, I think it was called, it was kind of like Karateka, which was like a side-scrolling kind of like a martial arts game. But it wasn't called Karateka. It was something else. But it was on the Commodore 64, and you would just kind of like walk across the screen and just beat people up.
I think it
was called Kung Fu Legend or something. Perhaps. But this one was, I think International Karate was more like it didn't scroll. I think it was just sort of, it took place in one screen.
Yeah.
But this particular game I liked a lot was it was kind of like a scrolling adventure game. You would scroll to the next one and fight these progressively harder characters. But I mean, pretty much any Commodore 64 game, I pretty much played all of them. I would say I played 90% of it. I remember this one game called Infiltrator, which had you flying a helicopter, and then you land and then you kind of infiltrate into the enemy base.
So, okay, what was your first kind of programming experience then?
I started programming my first year of university. I was learning to program the original Quake C. So I think when Quake was released, I think it was 1996 or something, they released the SDK for it, and the programming language that they were using was kind of like a subset of C. It was called Quake C. And that was really my first foray into programming. I was kind of self-taught. I think everything I learned was just from the internet forums back then, which were just really kind of crude message boards. Yeah, it was difficult, but yeah, that was probably my first exposure to programming.
Well, Quake was obviously a landmark in first-person shooters. I mean, did you kind of obviously play Doom and Wolfenstein 3D before that? I mean, what was it? Was FPS kind of like a big deal for you at the time when you first saw them? Do you remember?
Yeah. I mean, I played them all. I mean, originally it started out with Doom. I think that would be the first like FPS that really started it off. And ever since then, it kind of progressed to Duke Nukem and then Quake. And yeah, pretty much like all of those early 3D games, that they were really influential in my career. But yeah, I do remember working on Doom, but I didn't do any programming on it, unfortunately, because the only thing that it allowed you to do was create levels. So I think that was my first exposure to level creation.
So these kind of platforms, you know, they allow you to mod stuff. And were you really interested in just modding for another platform or developing a completely new platform yourself?
Oh, no, I was never really interested in developing a platform myself, because I realized the difficulty in creating an engine. And I was never very technically inclined to learn the really low-level knowledge required to make an engine, like stuff like writing the graphics API and working very closely with the view card and also the networking. The low-level stuff didn't really interest me. I was more interested in more of the intermediate language, the game code that would allow me to create games. So I was more interested in game design as opposed to engine creation.
So when you were at university, did you do much like LAN gaming and, you know, do you have parties and that kind of thing? Any friends that were into it?
Yeah. I mean, I remember playing a lot of Duke Nukem. Back then, Duke Nukem was really popular. And then in my second year of university, it kind of progressed to Quake. Actually, we didn't play LAN parties back then. I think most of the times I was playing over the internet. So right. I would just play over the modem. Oftentimes the connections would kind of disconnect. But yeah, I didn't really do much LAN partying per se. I think it was because I just wasn't really close to a lot of my friends. Physically close. But, I mean, geographically, I kind of lived in an area that was kind of remote from a lot of the people that I was playing with. So it wasn't easy to get together for a LAN. So yeah, most of it was done over.
To be fair, going to LAN parties back then, though, carrying a massive CRT monitor, it wasn't that easy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so... Yeah, unfortunately, I never got a chance to do one of those. But
when did you first play Half-Life and kind of decide that was a platform to start developing on?
Well, much like everyone else at the time, I think I got Half-Life as soon as it was released. It was kind of a milestone for the industry, and I think all of my close friends. We all just pretty much. We picked it up as soon as it was available. So yeah, I mean, you got to realize back then there wasn't many games released. At the time. So whenever there was a new game out, I mean, everybody just like quickly snatched it up. There was no hesitation because there wasn't really much else to play, to be honest. So I mean, as soon as we would pick up a game, we would just finish it and then we would grab the next game. And Half-Life at that time was the big hit for us. And pretty much everyone I knew picked it up. I never got much into the multiplayer mode of it, though. I think it was because at the time I was kind of bored of deathmatch. Like after having played Quake for so long, I was kind of like sick of the whole deathmatch gameplay. That's kind of when I decided to make Counter-Strike. Actually, previous to Half-Life, I actually worked on another mod called Action Quake 2. And that was the mod that actually kind of inspired a lot of what I did on Counter-Strike. Like it was like the mod that didn't have any respawns and it had a much more slower paced feel to it than the original Quake Deathmatch.
But Half-Life had a really good story as well, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It had a great single player. But that's not the reason why I actually chose to mod Half-Life, actually. I chose to mod Half-Life because the graphics and a lot of the physics and all that, it took place in a kind of a realistic setting. So that kind of made it easier for me to modify it. So at the time, there was a few engines that were available to choose from. I think... Unreal was one of them, and also the Monolith engine as well. But yeah, Half-Life appealed to me because it's so closely related in terms of the theme of Counter-Strike, in terms of just like the look and feel of it and the physics and all that. So I thought, well, it wouldn't require too much work for me to make Counter-Strike on Half-Life because I would just have to put, you know, some new characters and some new weapons, and I could use a lot of the I could use a lot of the level graphics from Half-Life and make
Well, it was very different with kind of PC titles back then because they favoured modders and having kind of community stuff. Were you ever kind of scared though that they might, you know, cut off the modders or kind of remove any of the functionality to enable people to mod?
Actually, I wasn't really too concerned about that, to be honest. I mean, it all started with Quake and ID Software. I mean, they were the first ones to really engage the community and really just build a bridge between the developer and the community in terms of creating mods. So ever since then, I mean, like Valve have been perfect. I mean, they've been extremely supportive of the community. So I never really felt, you know, that would go away. I always felt that those companies such as Valve, Epic Games, I always knew that they would exist because of their close relationship with the mod community.
Because I know there were some companies who like didn't like the modding scene at all, and like even threatened to sue like people that did them and that, didn't they, back then?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, nobody knew about this, but actually the early version of Counter-Strike, when we first started working on it, we were approached by Microsoft, and they told us to change the name Counter-Strike because they actually had a game in development called Counter-Strike.
Oh, wow.
But it wasn't released yet. So they were kind of threatening to sue us. But we kind of just said, we just kind of stuck to our guns. And then we released Counter-Strike, and eventually Counter-Strike became so popular that Microsoft kind of backed off and said, we're not going to bother. And I don't know why, but eventually they never finished their game called Counter-Strike. So that was kind of a weird situation for us. But yeah, I remember being approached by Microsoft telling us, hey, you got to change your name because we have a game in development called Counter-Strike. So.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, it was weird. They just, after we released it and it became popular, they just never talked to us again. But yeah, in terms of other mods that were being threatened, like the ones that use like, you know, Star Wars, the IP and all that, that was kind of that was always a threat, even in the early days. And that was something that I was always kind of, in the back of my mind, I knew I would never, you know, make a mod based on an established IP because I never wanted to get involved with that, the legal shenanigans of that. But yeah, I always try to avoid that.
You mentioned that you wanted a kind of a more realistic feel with the engine and kind of frustration with the deathmatch stuff. Did this lead you to creating this, you know, world of terrorism and counter-terrorism and very realistic guns?
I played a lot of Rainbow Six at the time, so that was probably a big influence in my decision to base Counter-Strike on terrorism. But in terms of the way the game design, in terms of like the round-based system, that's something that I kind of stole from my previous mod, I'll be honest. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like the weapons, the way that I came up with the buy system, that was actually kind of interesting because I never really expected it to be so, I guess, so popular. Like people kind of enjoy that economic of having to save up for a weapon. But I think the reason I came up with that was because I didn't want the guns to be so unbalanced. Like I didn't want to intentionally neuter certain guns so they would be more balanced with others. So I just came up with a system where, okay, you know, this gun is so much better. I'm just going to have to make it more difficult for players to acquire. So that's why I came up with the whole money system. Yeah, when you consider other games like Modern Warfare, they kind of like they try to make all the weapons balanced. They give like penalties to certain guns. So, you know, I wasn't really in favor of that though.
I particularly loved the knives, and I thought that was one of the first FPS that I saw with proper knives.
I guess I didn't really pay too much attention to the knives. The knives were just something that I remember the first version of Counter-Strike, we didn't even have knives. So whenever you ran out of bullets, it was kind of, yeah. I don't remember how they killed each other, I'll be honest.
Well, it got to a lot of knife matches. I remember that when I was a kid, just my knives only. That was it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I remember that. It was always kind of like, I mean, even even at the beginning of a match, people would kind of like have an honor system. Okay, this is only knives only. And then one person would pull out a gun and they would go to hell.
Every time.
Yeah, every time. But
when did you first realize how popular Counter-Strike was getting then? Was it quite a fast thing then, or did it take time? When did you realize how big it was?
It was kind of a gradual thing. I mean, I remember the first version we released was fairly well received, I guess. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was enough for me to motivate us to make another version. And then I think it was around the third version where we started to see really impressive like player numbers. And I think that's kind of when we felt, okay, we have something special here. I think we should just kind of continue to develop it. And I think around beta 4 was when Valve approached us. And I, at that time, I think we had more players than TFC. So I think that was kind of the moment where we felt, okay, this is definitely something special.
And were you quite heavily involved with the community around it then, and did you keep quite close to it?
Yeah, actually, we always, even from the first beta, actually, we had a very strong connection with the community. Because actually the community were the ones that were making all of the levels for us. It was only like the actual like development team was really just myself and my partner Flippy. He was the one that was managing our website, and also he would act as a liaison between the community. So he was the one that was kind of directly talking to all of the level designers for Counter-Strike, and he was kind of giving them suggestions on how to improve the levels and stuff like that. So the community were really a big reason of why Counter-Strike took off so quickly. It's because we were able to leverage that a lot of the talented level designers in the community to create the levels for us. And that's kind of why we were able to develop new versions so quickly.
I imagine it's really good to have instant feedback from the community as well. But I mean, there must have been quite a lot of it. Was it kind of a bit overwhelming sometimes trying to choose, you know, which path to go down with all that feedback?
Yeah, exactly. That's always a big problem with even AAA developer. But yeah, I remember just having to just kind of filter through all of the feedback and kind of gauge, okay, which one should we pay attention to and which one really is something that doesn't really apply to our game design. And that was always kind of like a difficult thing to do because, I mean, a lot of the game design in Counter-Strike, it's kind of personal as well because there was a lot of suggestions for us to do certain things, but we felt that it wasn't really something that I wanted the game to kind of go down towards. Like, for example, I think I remember when we introduced the sniper rifle, it was really, really powerful. And I remember we had, like the players can run around with it and snipe without having any penalties. When we introduced the change that kind of made it more difficult to move and snipe, a lot of the community were kind of against that. And I remember the majority of the players they wanted us to switch back to the old method. But I think we stuck to our guns and we kind of said, no, you know, this is ridiculous. We're going to make it so you can't snipe while running. And so I think decisions like that, they weren't always popular with the community, but I think in the end, people kind of accepted it, and I think it was better for the gameplay of Counter-Strike.
But also, you had a massive focus on creating developer tools for other people to develop for Counter-Strike. You don't really see that happening much with mods, you know, mods supporting developers for the mod. It's very interesting.
Yeah, actually, you know, the thing is, I don't remember making too much for the level design. I mean, because they were using a tool that was released by Valve. Like, they were using something called Hammer, which is a level editor. And I had to make a few changes to it so it would work for Counter-Strike, but I don't remember it being too extensive. I mean, a lot of the level designers, they would make some requests from me, and I do remember making a few changes for them, but it was never too difficult. I think we got along pretty well with our community. So,
well, Dust, of course, is a very famous map for CS, and I heard you weren't a fan of it at first.
Yeah, I think it was because it was too yellow and brown, and I was kind of sick of all these yellow levels. We were getting about 100 levels a week, and I at one point I remember getting like 90% of them were like just desert levels, and I was like, oh god, not another yellow level. So, I think that was the only reason why I was kind of turned off it. But I remember after we played it for a few days, I quickly grew warm to it because it was instantly obvious how balanced this level was and just how playable it was. It was actually one of the first levels that we felt it was perfect for the bombing mode. So, and also the guy who made it, he was such a nice guy that I had a hard time turning him down.
Well, it's really interesting because every version of Counter-Strike out there has a Dust as their main, most popular map, you know, so throughout the whole time period it's been put in everybody's psyche.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's been a de facto part of Counter-Strike. I mean, it goes, I would say it's probably like easily the most popular map, and for good reason too. I mean, it was just so well designed.
Have you heard of the artist Aram Barfo, who's trying to recreate the Dust map on a one-to-one scale?
In real life?
Yeah, in Germany.
Oh, Jesus.
I'll send a link. Really? He's really into it, and he's actually created, you know, a section of the map with giant dust crates he's made out of concrete and stuff.
Oh my god. Yeah, that's, I have not heard of that, but that's amazing. Yeah.
That would be surreal to walk around, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it would be very, very, like, yeah. Just having, like, a real paintball match there would be really cool.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Well, one thing I wondered, obviously, in that time period, you know, the early 2000s, it was kind of, you know, not everyone was on broadband then. A lot of people were still on dial-up internet. I mean, was it kind of a challenge to get decent speed of play with all these different connections that people had, some of them not very fast?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point, because I remember when I was playing Counter-Strike, the pings would vary between, you know, 10 milliseconds to, you know, up to 400, 500. And it was just something that we couldn't do, like, on our end. Like, there wasn't a lot that we could have done, like, to improve that situation. But I remember Valve, they did a lot of work in terms of making it balanced for the people with high ping. They introduced a lot of things like lag compensation. Those kind of things were really, really the backbone of what made Counter-Strike so playable for people of all different, like, internet qualities. And those are technologies that you see even to today. So I think it was really, really, it was a good job on Valve's part to really improve those technologies.
I imagine back then it must have been quite, you know, a challenge dealing with the traffic and hosting for servers with, you know, that many players.
We didn't do any hosting. Like, as we just kind of provided the game, and we provided the server files, and also, so basically, if someone wanted to host the server, they can just download the server and then just host it themselves. Nice. So everything was community driven. So there was no financial burden on us to host anything. So that was great. That was perfect.
Did you ever enter the game yourself and just kick everybody's ass and then say it's me?
Oh yeah, I mean I played a ton. I played a ton back then. I was pretty good. I don't think I was ever like top 1% or top 5% even, but I would say I would always end up in the top 10%, I would say. But yeah, I remember playing maybe like 4 hours a day. So I was really heavily into it. So I never got into a clan, but I just played it with my friends.
Well, one important factor about CS was the lobby. And I kind of remember that was one of the first games where I was sat there waiting for a game to start or players. It was a fantastic kind of interaction that you have in those lobbies, like a pre-match kind of... You know,
getting you warmed up and stuff.
Yeah, getting you warmed up.
Yeah, I don't remember too much of that, to be honest, but I remember just, like, we didn't have an elegant solution for it, so we just sort of said, okay, we won't start until enough players are here. So, you know, I mean, games these days, they'll have a nice screen and they'll have a nice chat system, so it's much more elegant. But yeah, back then I wasn't very I wasn't a very good programmer, so I didn't really have a good solution. So yeah, it was very crude.
This was also the first time I heard someone be able to broadcast audio on a mic. I don't know if that was after you were working with Valve, but that was a fascinating feature when you'd run around and someone would just shout something at you or play music to you.
Smack talk.
Yeah, exactly. That was completely Valve's work. That was something that they added to the Half-Life engine. So yeah, I don't exactly remember when it came about, but I do remember, like, a lot of the, just how it changed the community. I mean, you got a lot of, like, obvious kids just abusing it, but I think it really helped in terms of, like, a game like Counter-Strike, because I remember a lot of players would use it for communication, so, like, to improve their teamwork. So I thought that once they added that, it was really, really beneficial for, like team play, esports, that sort of thing, you know?
Well, taking a couple of steps back, I mean, do you remember when Valve first got in touch with you then and when you first heard from them?
Yeah, it was around Beta 3. I was actually working at another company up in Vancouver. We were working on another game. The company was called Barking Dog. So it's kind of a smaller company that I don't think it really made anything big. But I was working there and Valve approached me while I was working there. And they requested the company that I was working with to make Beta 5. So they contracted them out to make Beta 5 for them. And after they completed Beta 5, I eventually worked at Valve full-time, and they hired me to do it.
I remember a specific memory of going into a shop and seeing Counter-Strike on the shelves and thinking, yeah, wow, this mod has actually turned into a complete game. And
you know, the funny thing is, when Valve first approached us, the game was free, and when they offered to buy the license for us, we had no idea that they were going to sell it. I mean, we had no idea that they could sell a game that was free. I was like, you know, there's no way. How can you want, like, who would want to pay money for something that can download for free? So it really kind of it surprised me when they turned around, they made a standalone version of it. And I was like, wow, people going to buy that? I was like, you know, I was skeptical. I didn't know because, I was ignorant. I thought everybody in the world owned Half-Life. And I thought everybody in the world owned Half-Life. Why would they want to buy Counter-Strike? But it turns out that a lot of people didn't have Half-Life. And they bought the standalone Counter-Strike. So that was a big... it was a big surprise for me.
So were you not expecting to make any money then when you went into it?
No, because I had no idea they can sell a game that was free. I was so naive. I was like, what? You know? So I was super shocked. I was like, but you know, I mean, I kind of, you know, some people say, oh, you could have made so much, but I kind of, you know, I really value the time that I had at Valve, and I kind of value just being involved in them. And I think if it wasn't for Valve, Counter-Strike would not be as big as it is even till today. Because they really continue to support it, and they put a lot of work into it. So so I think they deserve a lot of the success that Counter-Strike's kind of not given them. So,
well, what was the story with Counter-Strike 2 then?
Oh, well, after I joined Valve, I was working on Counter-Strike. Well, I was working on a prototype that I was hoping to turn into Counter-Strike 2. But I was having so much problems working on it because I was working on the engine called Source Engine, which wasn't done at the time. So I was working on an engine that wasn't complete, and it was difficult for me to implement new features because the engine would constantly change. So that was one of the reasons why I had trouble making a prototype. And I think another reason I had making a prototype was I didn't have a good idea of what I wanted the sequel to be. I didn't really have a strong foundation or just a strong game design on what I could improve on the original Counter-Strike. I had a few ideas like vehicles and I wanted to add dogs and these things, but I wasn't able to implement them into the prototype because I wasn't the engine, the Source Engine, wasn't complete at the time, and it was giving me a lot of problems. So I think that and just my inexperience in game design kind of led to the project just being just kind of canned, and it never really took off. I was working on this prototype while Counter-Strike Source was being worked on. And they asked me, "Oh, you know, do you want to work on Counter-Strike Source?" And I was like, "No, I'd rather work on this because I want to make a new game. Counter-Strike Source was just, you know, Counter-Strike reskin, so it didn't interest me." So, yeah,
it's quite a lot to live up to, though, isn't it? Following up a game like Counter-Strike, I imagine that was, you know, it's kind of like, like doing a second movie after a blockbuster. It's like, you know,
yeah. And I think that kind of affected me as well. I really wanted it to be great, but I didn't know where to take it from there. I think I was just too inexperienced, and I just didn't have a strong like game design like background in order to really. So yeah, it never came to be. So,
So you ended up leaving Valve and worked on a new game, Tactical Intervention.
Yeah, that was oh god, that was a nightmare. I left Valve in 2006 or 7. We left on good terms, though. I mean, it was very much a mutual decision. Like they felt that I wasn't really enjoying my time there, and I wanted to work on a game that wasn't really restricted by the Counter-Strike name, like the whole phenomenon of Counter-Strike. So I just left, and I worked on this other game on my own for a couple of years, and then I was approached by this a guy in Korea, and he said, you're very famous in Counter-Strike, or you're very famous in Korea. I can get you in touch with a lot of these big publishers and these big developers. And so I moved there, and initially we were meeting with a lot of these big Korean publishers and developers like Nexon and CJ and all these. We pretty much met with every big Korean publisher, but the guy that I was working with, he was very controlling. He didn't want to lose control of this project, so he didn't want to work with them directly. So in the end, we never were able to work with anybody that was competent, and we ended up having to make this game TI on our own with like four people or something. Wow. Yeah, so it was a really small team, and we were just struggling to just make this game. And initially, it wasn't going to be a free-to-play game. So initially, it was just going to be a straight-up, you know, put it on Steam, sell it for $15, and that's it. And then being in Korea, everybody says, no, you have to make this free-to-play. There's no way, you know, there's no way it's going to do well if you don't do a free-to-play. So we had to turn it into a free-to-play game, and that involved a great deal of like changes to the engine, because in order to make it free to play, we had to develop our own lobby system and our own database system. So that required a great deal of work, and we had to hire this guy. And you know, it took another 2 years just to make it free to play. And then by then, I think the industry kind of like, I think at the time, like people were getting sick of like FPS or Counter-Strike. I think at the time there was kind of like a lull in like Counter-Strike's like popularity, and I think that was at the time when we decided to release the game TI, and yeah, it just flopped big time because we just weren't big enough to support like a free-to-play game, and we didn't have the infrastructure in terms of having enough servers, and also the game was very buggy. We didn't have enough, like we didn't test it at all. I remember testing it for like a week or two, and this wasn't our decision. Like, this is not something as a developer we wanted to do. It was because our publisher was very, very strict with our testing, and they were really cheap. They didn't want to host a server and have people play on it for free. So they wanted the testing period to last for like maybe 2 weeks. And that was not enough time for us to iron out all the bugs. And so we released this game that was really buggy, and it was really unpolished, and it was unbalanced. It had a lot of problems with it because we were not able to test it in a large scale environment. Like the most we ever tested it was with like maybe 100 people. You know, that's terrible. I mean, because when I was developing Counter-Strike, I got to test Counter-Strike with like thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, and they all provided feedback, and they all kind of guided me in how I should change the game. So that helped Counter-Strike become polished so quickly. But even then, that took 2 or 3 years. So when I was working on TI, we only had like 2 or 3 months to polish this game, to fix the bugs and to iron out all the gameplay kinks. And it was not enough time. So in the end, we ended up releasing this game that was really buggy and unbalanced, and people saw it. It was very obvious, and it was an embarrassment. Yeah, it was a big learning lesson for me. So I left in 2013, I think it was. Yeah, 2014. To join Facepunch, and I'm currently working on Rust now. So.
That must have been really disappointing, though. Yeah, when the game came out in a state that you weren't happy with.
Yeah, it was. You know, the thing is, it's kind of weird. People said to me, you know, this game is shit, right? And I'm like, I'm aware of that. I knew deep down inside this wasn't. I know this game had a lot of problems, and I didn't want to release it. But the thing is, the publisher was like, we have to release this now, and you know, they said, okay, we have to release this. So, yeah. I mean, when I was doing the marketing for it, it was very difficult because I was very kind of like torn. I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this marketing for this game that I'm not 100% behind. I know it's complete mess, and they want me to, you know, pretend that it's great. So it was I was very conflicted doing that. And even releasing it, I was very kind of, I mean, I think what I felt was I felt like I just want to get this over with. And if it's a hit, then wow, you know, that I'd be damn surprised. But if it's a failure, I just want to move on with my life. I think everybody on the team was just kind of like, they wanted to just get it over with and, you know, just kind of move on. But yeah, I remember just feeling a sense of, just a sense of desperation and a sense of, like resignation. I just wanted it to be over with. It was a difficult few years for me.
I guess you don't play that game anymore then.
God, no. I used to play it when it first released. There was a bit of it that I enjoyed. I mean, there's some things of it that I thought I did okay in it, but there was a lot of it that I felt I wish I had more time to really polish it. But yeah, it was a big embarrassment for me, and I don't mention it. So,
well,
I try not to bring it up.
Well, are you a fan of CSGO as well? And is there anything on that game you'd like to change?
You know, I mean, it looks nice, and but the thing is, the gameplay to me, it's just something that I've played to death. And you know, I played CS probably for like a good 7 or 8 years of my life. And to go back to CSGO, it's so similar to what I used to play that I don't think I would, because, I mean, these days I play other games. Like I play Battlefield 1. I guess I used to play a lot of Call of Duty. Not the future one, the old one, Modern Warfare 2. Yeah,
the best one.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't like it when they started getting all crazy and, you know, Unreal Tournament style. But but yeah, I enjoy the hell out of Battlefield 1. I don't know why. I guess I just prefer Battlefield 1 over CS:GO, is because I think as I'm getting older, my reflexes aren't as good, so I'm able to really enjoy a game like Battlefield a bit more than CS:GO.
Yeah, and I guess CS:GO is kind of
changed a lot from the original with skins and stuff like arms dealing and stuff like
that. Yeah, that kind of, you know, and I'll be honest, it kind of turns me off a bit because the reason I made Counter-Strike was because it had a very strong theme. It had a very consistent theme. And it really kind of delved with, you know, the whole counter-terrorist. And a lot of the units that we chose, they were realistic units like SAS and GIGN. And it kind of like, you know, it emphasized that. And the whole skins thing, it's kind of, it makes it more like a circus. And I just don't really enjoy that. Because when I play a game, I want to be kind of drawn into, like when I play Battlefield 1, I really enjoy that. It looks like World War 1. So yeah, that's kind of why I'm not a big fan of the skins.
And you're currently working on the fabulous game Rust at the moment, which is ultra realistic, kind of survival game. You know?
Yeah, it's a different game. It's a totally different game. I'll be honest, it's not the first game that I would be playing. It's a very difficult game because it requires a lot of time. I find I don't have enough time to really devote to playing it properly, so I tend not to play it too much. But yeah, I mean, it's so popular with a lot of the younger crowd who have that time, and I think it has a huge player base in that. So I'm really fortunate to be a part of this successful product, and I really enjoy working on it. Also, the team, the company that I work with, FaceBunch, they're a great bunch, and they really give me a great environment to work.
So have you got anything else in the pipeline? Anything else that you want to work on next?
You know, I in the back of my head, I always have a few ideas. I mean, I'd like to get back to FPS for sure, because I can't really imagine myself. I don't really play any other games anyway. So if I were to make another game, I would like to do an FPS. I would like to do something more kind of like, you know John Wick, kind of like that John Wick the movie. Yeah. So something like that. It was more, it kind of more like fantasy, but it's still grounded in reality. But it's, you know, it's a bit more stylistic than Counter-Strike per se. So I mean, I think something like that would be kind of fun to make a game based on.
Does virtual reality interest you at all?
No, not at all. I think I'm just the limitations in the movement and all that. Well, just the movement basically. Mm-hmm. If they can figure that out, then I'd be interested in it. But until then, I'm not interested in it, because I think for me the biggest part of games is movement. I think that's a big part of all games that I play. Like, it's just the way that the player can move and just the feeling of movement. Like the speed in which players can move, it's not like being able to do that in a game is part of the appeal for me. So,
yeah, till everybody's got a virtual reality room in their house, it's a bit of a way up yet, isn't it?
Yeah,
and a treadmill.
Yeah, and another thing is, even if we did have the space to do all that, I think another problem with virtual reality is people just can't do what we can do in games, and I think that's one of the reasons why I enjoy playing games. Is because I can't run that fast, nor can I do that much movement in a given amount of time. So I think, you know, if you made a game that where I had to do in real life, it wouldn't be as fun. I'd get tired, and, you know, I don't think a lot of people can actually keep up with it. So
yeah, trip
you would have a
bar.
Very restricted game.
Excellent, man. Well, listen, we really appreciate you talking to us this week. That was really interesting.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
And if people want to keep up to date with what you're doing, have you got a website, Twitter, anywhere that they can follow you on?
I do have Twitter. Let me just check what it's called. I don't know what it's called. But it's called at GoosemanCS.
Cheers.
Excellent, man. Well, lovely talking to you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, guys. Have a good day.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.